as underrepresented voices, as well as a showcase of women-led businesses in the Kingston community. It's sure to be the event of the season. Doors are at 7 p.m. and tickets can be found at ticketscene.ca.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
Banter.
When I say beat, you say banter. Beat.
Banter.
Beat.
Banter.
Join us every Thursdays at 1 on CIC for your special time with your favorite nuclear family.
My name is Aiden.
And this is Ella.
And you're listening to The Only Show.
Beat Banter.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Ukraine regards any negotiations on Ukraine without Ukraine as ones that have no result, and we cannot recognize any agreements about us made without us.
As high-level U.S.-Russia talks get underway in Saudi Arabia, Ukraine is not invited. We'll host a discussion with economist Jeffrey Sachs and former Bernie Sanders advisor Matt Duss. Then to the Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land, about Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians in one community in the West Bank.
My name is Basa. I grew up in a small community called Misafer Yatta. I started the film when we started to end.
We'll speak with the film's Oscar-nominated Palestinian director, Basil Adra, for an update on continuing Israeli attacks and demolitions on his community and across the West Bank. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Top diplomats from the United States and Russia are meeting in Saudi Arabia to discuss ways to possibly end the war in Ukraine and improve relations between Washington and Moscow. Participants include U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was not invited to attend and has said he won't recognize a peace deal negotiated without Ukraine. Zelensky is scheduled to be in Saudi Arabia tomorrow. The meeting comes less than a week after President Trump held a 90-minute call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. On Monday, European leaders gathered for an emergency meeting in Paris amidst a growing rift between Europe and the United States over Ukraine and other issues. European nations are divided on proposals for European troops to be deployed inside Ukraine to help secure Ukraine if a peace deal is reached with Russia. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer backs sending peacekeeping troops to Ukraine if a deal is reached.
At stake is not just the future of Ukraine. It is an existential question for Europe as a whole, and therefore vital for Britain's national interest.
German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said it's highly inappropriate to be discussing sending European troops to Ukraine at this time. The United Nations Lebanon envoy is accusing Israel of violating the November ceasefire by not fully withdrawing from southern Lebanon by today's deadline. While some Israeli troops have left the area, Israel's decided to keep forces at five strategic locations. On Monday, Israel carried out a deadly drone strike in southern Lebanon. The target was reportedly a Hamas commander. Palestinian officials in Gaza have accused Israel of violating the month-long ceasefire 266 times. Since the ceasefire began January 19th, Israeli attacks have killed at least 132 Palestinians. Meanwhile, newly freed Palestinian prisoners have revealed new details about being tortured inside Israeli prisons. Tarek Rabia Safi spoke in Khan Yunis after being freed in the latest captive swap.
I was among those detained in Hamad City in Khan Yunis on March 3, 2024. I was held by the Israeli army in the Gaza envelope, which is in Sidi Tamam Military Detention Center, where I stayed for 4 months, and I was subjected to torture of our bodies, physical torture, and hunger. We were also subjected to torture by stray dogs, the dogs of the Israeli army.
In other news from Gaza, the publication 972 has revealed Israeli soldiers used an 80-year-old Palestinian man as a human shield to help them scout out abandoned buildings in Gaza City last May. Israeli soldiers put an explosive cord around the man's neck to prevent him from escaping, even though he walked with a cane. After 8 hours, Israeli troops let the elderly man and his wife evacuate on foot, but the couple were soon shot dead by another Israeli battalion. In news from the occupied West Bank, Israel's reportedly planning to build nearly 1,000 new settler homes in the Efrat settlement near Jerusalem. The Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The group Shalom Achshav, Peace Now, condemned the move, saying the Netanyahu government is trying, quote, to establish facts on the ground that will destroy the chance for peace and compromise, unquote. This comes as Israel's ongoing military operations in the West Bank have displaced at least 45,000 Palestinians, the most since the 1967 war. Here in New York, four top deputies of New York City Mayor Eric Adams have resigned over the mayor's agreement to help support the Trump's immigration crackdown in exchange for the dismissal of corruption charges against him. Seven prosecutors in the Justice Department had already resigned in protest. New York Governor Kathy Hochul, who has the power to remove Adams from office, though it's never been done before in U.S. history, is meeting with city leaders today. On Monday, thousands of protesters took to the streets across the United States to speak out against Donald Trump and Elon Musk's moves to radically dismantle the federal government in what many have likened to a coup. Protests were held in all 50 state capitals and many other cities. Many of the protests were under the banner of Not My President's Day. At a protest in New York, Jay Walker of Rise and Resist spoke to Democracy Now!
We've got Elon Musk and Donald Trump and the Doge bros, the tech bros, ripping our government to shreds, ripping our Constitution to shreds, just ignoring the rule of law. The American people have to stand up to it.
In Washington, D.C., protesters gathered outside the U.S. Capitol and the White House.
The ends do not justify the means. There's a right way and a wrong way to accomplish change. And President Trump has broken every rule of appropriate democratic change in our society.
In more news about Elon Musk, the Trump administration's purge of federal workers has targeted staff at the Food and Drug Administration who were reviewing Elon Musk's brain implant company, Neuralink. According to Reuters, the Trump administration fired about 20 people in the FDA's Neurological and Physical Medical Devices Division, which was overseeing clinical trial applications by Neuralink. The Trump administration and Elon Musk are also facing criticism over the firing of hundreds of workers at the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. On Monday, a team from Musk's private SpaceX company visited the FAA's Air Traffic Control Command Center in Virginia. Musk previously forced out the FAA administrator, Michael Whitaker. This comes at a time of increased anxiety over flying. There have been four major plane crashes over the past month. On Monday, a Delta flight from Minneapolis crashed while landing in Toronto. The plane flipped upside down on the runway. At least 18 people were injured. The acting head of the Social Security Administration has resigned after refusing to give Elon Musk and the so-called Department of Government Efficiency access to sensitive personal information about hundreds of millions of Americans. The official, Michelle King, had spent decades at the agency. It's unclear what sensitive information DOGE has obtained. The new acting head of the agency is a low-level official who's publicly praised DOGE. In health news, a new study is projecting as many as 20 million people could lose Medicaid coverage under a Republican congressional bill to cut the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion match rate. The American Hospital Association has harshly criticized the proposal, saying, quote, Medicaid provides health care to many of our most vulnerable populations, including pregnant women, children, the elderly, disabled, and many of our working class, unquote. President Trump has nominated Ed Martin to be the top federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. 4 years ago, Martin helped organize the Stop the Steal protests that aimed to overturn the 2020 presidential election. He later represented some of the January 6th insurrectionists. He's also a longtime anti-abortion activist who has pushed for a national abortion ban and the jailing of women who undergo abortions. Three Venezuelan immigrants who won a temporary restraining order against the Trump administration blocking their transfer to Guantanamo were deported on Monday. In recent weeks, dozens of Venezuelans have been flown to the U.S. naval prison in Cuba as Trump claims to be targeting the worst of the worst. But new reports show many of the at least 150 Venezuelan immigrants now imprisoned at Guantanamo had never been convicted of violent crimes. In related news, the Tucson-based independent outlet Arizona Luminaria is reporting an undocumented Venezuelan mother and two of her children were deported to southern Mexico just hours after a minor traffic stop. Arizona public safety troopers claimed the mother, identified as Isenia, was driving under the speed limit. She described being handcuffed in front of her children, aged 6 and 9. The troopers called Border Patrol agents who apprehended Yesenia and her two children and later turned them over to Mexican immigration officials in the border city of Nogales before they were put on a bus and driven about 2,000 miles away to the southern Mexican state of Tabasco. The mother was incommunicado for days until she was finally able to call her family, letting them know of her whereabouts. Her two other children, who are 8 and 14 years old, are still in Tucson. Pope Francis has spent a fortnight hospitalized in Rome, where he's being treated for a respiratory tract infection. In recent weeks, the 88-year-old Pope has spoken out against the Trump administration's anti-immigrant policies. In a letter to U.S. bishops, the Pope wrote, quote, "The act of deporting people who in many cases have left their own land for reasons of extreme poverty, insecurity, exploitation, persecution, or serious deterioration of the environment damages the dignity of many men and women and of entire families and places them in a state of particular vulnerability and defenselessness," the Pope wrote. In Sudan, reports have emerged of over 200 people killed, including women and children, after a three-day brutal assault by rapid support forces on villages in the southern White Nile state. Doctors Without Borders is warning hundreds of thousands of people could die in Sudan from famine after the Trump administration froze foreign aid. The aid cutoff forced the shutdown of critical community kitchens across Sudan. Meanwhile, UN officials on Monday said some $6 billion is needed to address the worsening humanitarian crisis in Sudan, which human rights experts have described as the world's worst ever hunger catastrophe. A fifth of Sudan's population has been mass displaced following 22 months of war.
Because this is a humanitarian crisis that is truly unprecedented in its scale and gravity, and it demands a response unprecedented in scale and intent. It's a crisis that is increasingly crossing Sudan's borders, threatening to destabilize neighbors in ways that risk being felt for generations to come.
In Uganda, authorities have dropped a military trial against the prominent opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who will now be charged in a civilian court instead. Besigye, a four-time presidential candidate, has been detained since November after he went missing, reappearing days later inside a cage in front of a military tribunal in Kampala. His supporters say he faces several politically motivated charges, including treachery, which carries the death penalty. Besigye was recently rushed to the hospital after going on hunger strike last week. In Argentina, opposition lawmakers are calling for the impeachment of President Javier Milei after lawyers filed fraud charges against the Trump-loving far-right leader for endorsing a cryptocurrency that quickly crashed, triggering millions of dollars in loss. In the Trump administration's latest attack on the press, Elon Musk has called for the jailing of staff at 60 Minutes after the CBS program aired a segment criticizing his push to freeze USAID funding. A 60 Minutes report on Sunday included this line, quote, "The world's richest man cut off aid for the world's poorest people," unquote. Musk responded on a social media platform by writing, quote, 60 Minutes are the biggest liars in the world. They deserve a long prison sentence, unquote. President Trump already has a pending $20 billion lawsuit against CBS over a different 60 Minutes segment. Meanwhile, in other media news, The Washington Post, which is owned by billionaire Jeff Bezos, has refused to run a wraparound ad from Common Cause that called for Trump to fire Elon Musk. The ad showed a picture of Musk and the White House with the words, "Who's running this country, Donald Trump or Elon Musk?" And longtime political prisoner and indigenous activist Leonard Peltier is set to be released from a Florida prison today after spending nearly half a century behind bars. For decades, Peltier, who is 80 years old, has maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Last month, President Biden commuted Peltier's life sentence to serve the remainder of his time under house arrest. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, as high-level U.S.-Russia talks are underway in Saudi Arabia, Ukraine's not invited. We'll host a discussion with economist Jeffrey Sachs and former Bernie Sanders advisor Matt Des. Stay with us. Man's House, performed by the Resistance Revival Chorus during Monday's Not My President's Day protest here in New York City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with the high-level talks between Russian and U.S. officials in Saudi Arabia, where they're meeting to discuss a possible end to the war in Ukraine and ways to improve ties between Washington and Moscow. The talks include U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and might pave the way for a possible meeting between President Trump and Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Today's talks come less than a week after Trump held a 90-minute call with Putin. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who will be in Saudi Arabia on Wednesday on a separate state visit, was not invited to attend the U.S.-Russian talks. Zelensky spoke to reporters Monday.
Ukraine will not take part in the talks in Saudi Arabia. Ukraine did not know anything about them. Ukraine regards any negotiations on Ukraine without Ukraine as ones that have no result. And we cannot recognize any agreements about us made without us and will not recognize such agreements.
Zelensky also rejected a demand by the Trump administration for Ukraine to give the United States ownership of half of Ukraine's rare earth minerals as compensation for past and future aid to Ukraine. He called for stronger American security guarantees as part of any minerals deal. Meanwhile, at an emergency European summit on Ukraine held in Paris Monday, European leaders were divided on proposals for European troops to be deployed inside Ukraine in the event of a peace deal. While German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said it was highly inappropriate to be discussing sending troops before a peace deal is reached, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer offered to send British troops to Ukraine.
At stake is not just the future of Ukraine. It is an existential question for Europe as a whole, and therefore vital for Britain's national interest. Europe must play its role, and I'm prepared to consider committing British forces on the ground alongside others if there is a lasting peace agreement.
Commenting on the meeting, Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said she was concerned about what she called Russia's imperial dreams.
I am very concerned about making a fast ceasefire, because it can actually give Putin and Russia a better possibility to go back to Russia and to re-ramp and to mobilize again, attack Ukraine or another country in Europe.
For more on all of this, we're joined by two guests. From Washington, D.C., Matt Duss is with us, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders. His latest piece for The Guardian: Democrats have become the party of war. Americans are tired of it. Matt Duss's recent foreign policy piece is It's Time for Ukraine to Make the Best Peace It Can. And in Brussels, we're joined by Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. He served as advisor to three UN secretaries general, is now a sustainable development solutions advocate under Secretary General Antonio Guterres. His piece for Common Dreams is headlined "The War in Ukraine Was Provoked and Why That Matters to Achieve Peace." Let's begin with Professor Sachs in Brussels. You're going to be involved with an event in Brussels tomorrow, the Geopolitics of Peace. Can you talk about what's happening right now in Saudi Arabia? You have the representatives of President Trump and President Putin, who have just been involved with 4 hours of negotiations. You have Zelensky meeting with the Turkish president and now headed to Saudi Arabia for different meetings, and he said nothing about us without us. But can you talk about what's happening now in Saudi Arabia and the possibility of peace?
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Matt. What's happening in Saudi Arabia is potentially very good news. It could mean the end of a war in which perhaps a million Ukrainians have died or been wounded gravely up until now. This is a war that never should have happened. It came about because of several provocative U.S. actions over 30 years, notably the expansion of NATO eastward against commitments made back in 1990, the U.S. participation in a violent coup in Ukraine in February 2014, the U.S.-Ukraine agreement to discard a U.N. Security Council-backed Minsk II agreement, and the failure of the Biden administration to negotiate with President Putin in December 2021 and January 2022. I was personally involved in watching closely all of those events over the past 30 years. This war never should have happened. It could have been averted at many times. It could have ended in negotiation in March 2022, saving the lives of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. I urged it. The Ukrainians walked away from the table because the British and the Americans told them to. This is so tragic, and everyone will understand this as the historians make all of this very clear. I flew to Ankara in the spring of 2022 to understand exactly how these negotiations had broken down. And the United States and Britain were behind it because, as Keith Starmer said in the clip that you played, this is about Europe's security. They're using Ukraine. This is the bottom line. So what's happening, in short, in Saudi Arabia is the most positive news for Ukrainians that there has been in years. President Trump understands, and unfortunately, previous presidents did not, that the U.S. provocations need to stop so this war stops, so the deaths stop. That is the bottom line. I think it's important for everybody to understand also that on October 5th, 2022, Zelensky ruled out any negotiations. He said it's illegal. This was a declaration of the Ukrainian government. So the government of Ukraine, sadly, really unwisely, I've tried many, many times to explain to them, they ruled out negotiations. They ruled them out until today. This is tragic for them. Now they say, we want a seat at the table. They said, we don't want any table all along. And Zelensky rules by martial law, by decree, when the opinion surveys show that a majority of Ukrainians want peace right now, even at the cost of territorial concessions. So my bottom line, Amy, is that while the Trump administration does some pretty weird things like demanding mineral rights, this is absurd. This is completely bizarre. At the same time, the Trump administration, for the first time, is telling the truth about the fundamental causes of this war and how it can end. And that is the best news possible for Ukraine, first and foremost, and for the United States, for Russia, and for the world, that peace could come to Ukraine very, very shortly. So this, I think, is the bottom line.
Yeah, I'd like to bring in Matt Dussin to the conversation. Matt, your reaction to the events and the Trump administration's complete reversal of the previous administration's policy, and this whole issue of whether there could have been peace earlier on, but that the Biden administration and the British scuttled the developing peace plan back 2 years ago.
Well, I mean, first off, and again, great to be with you and great to be here with Professor Sachs. I mean, I think, you know, the story that Professor Sachs just told, well, there are elements of truth to it, but there are also, it's a great deal in there that's misleading and frankly completely one-sided, absolving Vladimir Putin of any responsibility. Vladimir Putin is the one who chose to invade Ukraine, let's remember. It's important to understand the history. Important to understand that the role that NATO expansion has played as being seen as a threat to Russia, that is real. That, however, does not explain Vladimir Putin's decision to illegally invade, annex, and occupy parts of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin himself has told us multiple times what his vision for Ukraine is, and that's to retake Ukraine and make it once again part of the larger Russian imperium. So again, important to understand the historical context, but I would really warn against seeing, Vladimir Putin as some kind of innocent victim of American machinations here, which is the story that Professor Sachs seems to be trying to tell. And lastly, it really denies the Ukrainians any agency, any responsibility for their own independence, for their own democracy. The Ukrainians are not simply being treated as instruments of American power here. The Ukrainians have made decisions on their own. Some of them have been wise, some of them very admirable, some of them less so. I think we can discuss that as well. But they have played a major role here, and I think that is what's concerning about these talks going on in Saudi Arabia, is that they are not there and they're not included. And they have said, President Zelensky has said, that they will not be bound by any decisions made without their participation, which I think we can all agree is quite a legitimate position. Now, having said that, you know, this is not the first time you've had a U.S. administration engaging with the government of Vladimir Putin. Of course, President Biden met with Putin in June 2021. They had a summit trying to address some issues of tension in the U.S.-Russia relationship. And I think this also goes to the point that President Biden did not seek a conflict with Russia. There were efforts made to avert the invasion. There was very intensive diplomacy between the U.S. and Russia, also between the U.S.'s allies, Germany, France, UK, and Russia leading up to the February 2022 invasion. And I think it's worth taking that into account. Now, should more have been done? Perhaps. We can't know. But I think Vladimir Putin has told us repeatedly about his very expansive goals and what he really hopes to achieve in Ukraine. And it's not just about NATO. I mean, this should not be news to anyone here. Again, getting back to the talks in Saudi Arabia, if there is a workable peace agreement to be had, that's good. But I do think even the fact that these talks are happening between the United States and Russia, that is a victory for Putin. We have to understand that. Putin's vision for Russia's role and for the eventual dispensation for Ukraine is that this is something to be worked out between Russia and the United States, between these two great powers. He sees Russia as a rising force. Again, he's trying to kind of reestablish Russia as a great empire, a great force in global affairs. And his vision of how global affairs should work is that the great powers make decisions and the lesser powers just have to deal with it. Their concerns are of very little concern. And unfortunately, I think that is something we've seen from the Trump administration, too, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Gaza. It's that the powerful make decisions and the weak just deal with it. I don't think that's just. And more importantly, I don't think that's going to lead to a sustainable peace. So listen, if they do come out of these talks with a workable and sustainable and durable peace agreement for Ukraine, one that protects Ukraine's democracy, one that protects Ukraine's sovereignty, we should all support that. But without the participation of Ukraine, I'm very, very skeptical that we're going to get anything like that.
And Jeff Sachs, what about that? It is the Ukrainians who are actually fighting against Russia, and yet the Trump administration seems to feel that it can negotiate without Ukrainians present. And in addition to that, I wanted to ask you another issue. There's been a lot of emphasis on these rare earth minerals that Trump raised, but there has been, according to many reports, massive buying of Ukrainian land by American agribusiness companies. Can you tell us anything about that, the validity of these claims?
Sure. The American role in this has been quite sordid for a very, very long time. The goal, starting back in 1994, was to expand NATO and surround Russia in the Black Sea region. President Clinton signed off on that in 1994. Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote about it in the Grand Chessboard in 1997, explaining it, and explaining in a chapter that is completely wrong when you look back at it, said Russia will not be able to resist any of this. In 2002, the U.S. destabilized the relationship by unilaterally abandoning the anti-ballistic missile treaty. In 2008, the United States invited Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO, basically over strong objections by the Europeans, but the Europeans went along in the NATO Bucharest summit in 2008, over Russia's brightest red lines. This was all known, understood provocations. All of the diplomats knew it. European leaders knew it. I spoke with them at the time. Everybody understood this. In February 2014, the United States participated actively in a violent coup to overthrow Viktor Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, who favored neutrality. This is very important to understand. The coup took place on February 22nd, 2014. Again, I saw some of this with my own eyes. It was ugly. The U.S. involvement in this coup. U.S. forces paid for this coup to an important extent. They stirred up this coup. This is all well understood. Now, in 2015, the war could have ended with the Minsk II agreements, but the United States and Ukraine, despite the U.N. Security Council backing, said, no, you don't have to do that. That was not a territorial claim on the Donbas by Russia. It was a claim for autonomy that the UN Security Council unanimously supported, and the US and the governments in Ukraine, at the US behest to an important extent, completely dissed. And then it's true that Biden and Putin met in 2021, but in December 2021, President Putin put on the table a draft U.S.-Russia security agreement. It was a completely negotiable document. I spent quite a bit of time speaking with the White House about that document. There should have been negotiations. The U.S. rejected negotiation over the central point, which was non-NATO enlargement to Ukraine. Biden knew what he was doing. It was a terrible mistake, terrible mistake of the Democrats, let me say, and of President Biden and his team. Then in March 2022, just days after the start of Russia's invasion, but by the way, the war had been going on for years, but this escalation in starting February 22nd, 2022, just days after that, they went to the negotiating table. And they came very close to an agreement until the U.S. and Britain stopped it. Bojo, Boris Johnson, one of the most irresponsible politicians in our modern time, explained it explicitly later. He said this is a war about preserving Western hegemony. Yes, this was a proxy war against Russia. This was the plan all along. And the U.S. and U.K. talked or told Zelensky, basically, leave. Now, again, as I said earlier, I went to Ankara to discuss this in detail with the diplomats. I know the details of what happened. Ukraine left the negotiations that could have ended this in March 2022 with few deaths. And instead, there have been nearly a million deaths since then. This has been, unfortunately, a game of the United States for 30 years that Zbigniew Brzezinski spelled out in 1997. The U.S. thought they had the upper hand at every time. It was the economic sanctions or the weapons that were going to bring Russia to its knees. It was incredibly naive. I said so for many, many years.
Professor Sachs.
I said Ukraine will become the Afghanistan of Europe, and so it has. Now, today in Saudi Arabia, maybe Ukraine can be saved from what the U.S. deep state set along the path of the last 25 years.
Professor,
and this is
Sachs,
the biggest hope of today.
Professor Sachs, Matt Dust said he agreed with a lot of what you said. And I was wondering if you agree with him in condemning Russia's invasion in 2022.
Of course I condemn Russia's invasion. And of course I condemn the reasons for the provocation. I condemn the destabilization of the nuclear framework, which was the most important element of all in this. The United States walked out of the ABM Treaty and the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty unilaterally and would not negotiate with the Russians over this. The United States overthrew a government in Ukraine. The United States refused to negotiate with the Russians over basic security issues. This is a tragedy. But the core of the tragedy is U.S. unipolarity assumed by the neocons as early as 1992, put in place by Clinton starting in 1994, and it's been a consistent U.S. policy up until today, basically. And Trump is actually, amazingly, it seems, trying to change it, which is unbelievable for us. I voted for Biden, of course. I was also an advisor to Bernie Sanders. I just want to be clear. This is a shock to me that it's coming from this side of the American politics. The Dems became warmongers.
Matt,
period.
That certainly also reverberates with your title about the Democrats becoming the party of war. The latest news out of Riyadh, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says officials at U.S.-Russia talks agreed to restore embassy staffing, create a high-level team to negotiate peace in Ukraine, peace and promote economic cooperation. Your thoughts on this and where this history goes from there?
Yeah, I mean, I read that readout. I think it's interesting. I would also note that one of those points is not just economic cooperation, but, quote, investment opportunities. So, again, it really does seem like the Trump administration is not just trying to make peace, but trying to, you know, talk about potentially dividing the spoils with Russia. And that is very concerning because I don't think that's going to lead to a sustainable and durable peace agreement. But again, in basic terms, it's good and fine that the United States and Russia are talking. We need to talk to our adversaries more generally. I think that's always true. But the details will matter. And again, Ukraine's buy-in is absolutely necessary for this. This is not an agreement that can be made over their heads. And I do want to step back and just respond to a couple of things that Professor Sachs said in the kind of history that he laid out. It is very interesting to me that the Ukrainians themselves play little, if any, role in the history that Professor Sachs just lays out. This idea that 2014 was just a U.S.-backed coup is false. Yanukovych was overthrown after one of the largest demonstrations in Ukraine's history, known as the Euromaidan. It was not the case that Yanukovych simply wanted to make Ukraine neutral. He wanted to draw Ukraine closer to Russia in a way that an overwhelming majority of Ukrainians rejected. So we need to understand the history in all its complexity here. The Ukrainian people played a major role in that event. They played a major role in the decision to resist quite admirably and courageously the Russian invasion of their own country. Now, going back to the negotiations in March of 2022, I think to treat the talks that took place in Turkey as if they would have simply ended the war, again, is not accurate. Now, there were interesting possibilities in those talks. There's little evidence that Putin himself was completely bought in. I'm very skeptical that having launched a major invasion a month before, he would have been willing simply to end that invasion. But again, this story that Professor Sachs is telling of the United States as the major manipulator and the key problem, and everyone else is simply reacting to what the United States does, I think does not really reckon with reality. I'm certainly a critic of U.S. foreign policy. I'm a strong critic of the Biden administration's foreign policy. But I do think if we want to have a real and honest discussion about where U.S. foreign policy has failed and where it needs to go, we need to reckon with the actual complex history of these events. And it's not just a story of unending U.S. villainy.
And Matt, just briefly, because we're running out of time for this segment, the Trump administration has also been pushing for increased military expenditures by the NATO countries from 2%. Now he wants 5% of their GDP in terms of military spending. What's your response? Because obviously the United States, as the main producer of weapons in the world, would benefit from such increased military spending by the various countries of Europe.
Right. I mean, this is the point that Trump has made repeatedly, and not just Trump. And I mean, if you remember, Barack Obama was also someone who was pushing NATO member countries to meet their commitments. By raising that commitment, it's something very interesting from Trump if he expects that they'll be buying these weapons from the United States. But I think one potentially interesting positive consequence of Trump's approach here is that if it really does force the Europeans to finally, at long last, start taking more serious steps to see to their own security. I mean, some of the comments that were played earlier from Keir Starmer, I'm not so sure about the idea of UK troops patrolling Ukraine. But just the fact that you see European governments now stepping up and looking much with a bit more urgency about their own responsibilities in their own neighborhood, I do think that could have potential, positive consequences for the United States, given the way that, the U.S. Security architecture in Europe is something that helps buttress our own military-industrial complex and diminishes and, I think, really corrupts our own democracy. So anything that weakens the military-industrial complex, I would say, is all to the good.
Matt Dass, we want to thank you for being with us, Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont, and economist Jeffrey Sachs, speaking to us from Brussels at the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University. We'll link to all of your articles, both Matt and Jeffrey. When we come back, we speak with the Palestinian co-director Bassel Adra about his Oscar-nominated documentary, No Other Land, and about Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians from his community in the West Bank, what the film is about. Stay with us.
غصن اللي انكسر بعد ما نسي بعد الحجر قاعد صافي النفس. قصص السما بعد ما قسي بعد البحر شارد حامل كل السفن بعد ما رسي بعد في ذكرى بالقلب محمولة فيها بقى يا رمشي خصلة شعر بتفي
Fragments of Memory by Firas Suleiman featuring Dima Zahran. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to the occupied West Bank, where Israel is reportedly planning to build nearly 1,000 new settler homes in the Efrat settlement near Jerusalem. The Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The group Shalom Achshav, Peace Now, condemned the move, saying the Netanyahu government is trying, quote, to establish facts on the ground that'll destroy the chance for peace and compromise, end quote. This comes as Israel's ongoing military operations in the West Bank have displaced at least 45,000 Palestinians, the most since the 67 war. Today, the Oscar-nominated Palestinian director, Bassel Adra, shared video from the occupied West Bank of Israeli forces storming and demolishing four houses in Masafa Ayata. Earlier this month, Bassel Adra himself filmed armed and masked Israeli settlers attacking his community of Masafer Yatta. The settlers threw stones, smashed vehicles, slashed tires, punctured a water tank. Israeli soldiers on the scene did not intervene to halt the crimes. Bassel Adra's Oscar-nominated documentary, No Other Land, is about Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians living in Masafer Yatta. In another post last week, Bassel wrote, quote, anyone who cared about No Other Land should care about what's actually happening on the ground. Today, our water tanks, 9 homes, 3 ancient caves were destroyed. Masafer Yatta is disappearing in front of my eyes. Only one name for these actions, ethnic cleansing, he said. In a minute, Bassel Adra will join us for an update. But first, we want to play the trailer from his Oscar-nominated documentary, No Other Land.
You think they'll come to our home?
Is the army down there?
1,000 Palestinians face one of the single biggest expulsion decisions since the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories began.
Bassel, come here. Come fast.
This is a story about power. My name is Bassel. I grew up in a small community called Masafer Yatta. I started to film when we started to end.
They have bulldozers?
I'm filming you.
I need air, oh my God.
Don't worry.
I don't want them to take our home.
You're Bassel?
Yes.
You're Palestinian?
No, I'm Jewish.
He's a journalist. You're Israeli. Seriously.
We have to raise our voices, not being silent as if no human beings live here.
What? The army is here?
This is what's happening in my village now. Soldiers are everywhere.
Who do you think you're filming, you son of a whore?
It would be so nice with stability one day. Then you'll come visit me. Not always me visiting you, right?
Maybe. What do you think? If you were in my place, what would you do?
That's the trailer for the Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land, co-directed by the Israeli journalist Yuval Abraham and our next guest, Bas Ladra, Palestinian activist and journalist who writes for 972 magazine. His most recent piece headlined, "Our film is going to the Oscars, but here in Masafer Yatta, we're still being erased." Basel has spent years documenting Israeli efforts to evict Palestinians living in his community, Masafer Yatta, south of Hebron. Basel, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about your film and also what's happening right now. This is not a film about history. It's on the ground now. You recently were barricaded in your house filming what was going on, what the Israeli settlers were doing.
Thank you for having me. Our movie, we worked in it for the last 5 years. We are four people, two Israelis and two Palestinians, me, myself, Yuval and Rachel and Hamdan, who's my friend and living in Masafer Yatta. We are just activists and journalists, and me and my friend Hamdan spent years in the field running after bulldozers, soldiers and settlers and in our communities and communities around us, filming the destruction, the home destructions, the school destructions, the cutting of our water pipes and the bulldozering of our roads and our own schools, and trying to raise awareness from the international community on what's going on, to get political impact, to try to stop this from happening and to protect our community. And 5 years ago, Yuval and Rachel joined as Israeli journalists to write about what's happening, and then we decided together that we will start working on No Other Land as a documentary that show the whole political story through personal individual stories of people who lost their life and homes and school and properties on this, like in the last years and also in the decades of the occupation. We released the movie in the Berlinale 2024 last year at the festival, and so far it has been like doing and screened and showed like in many festivals around the world.
And Basel, your film has received an Oscar nomination, but you haven't been able to find a distributor in the U.S. What do you know about this refusal of any company to pick up your film to distribute? And also, can it be seen in the West Bank or in Israel itself?
I mean, it's sad that we don't find a U.S. distributor. Our goal from making this documentary, it's not the award, it's not the awards itself, but the people and the audience, and to get to the people's hearts, because we want people to see the reality, to see what's going on in my community in Masafer Yatta, but in all the West Bank, to the Palestinians, and how the life. The daily life under this brutal occupation. People should be aware of this, because they are, and somehow they have responsibility. In the U.S., it's the tax money that the people paying there. It's have something to do with the home destruction that we're facing. The settlers' violence, the building of the settlements on our land that does not stop every day. And we as a collective made this movie. We faced so many risks on the field, on the ground, like my home was invaded and the cameras were confiscated from my home by Israeli soldiers, and I was physically attacked on the field when I'm going around and filming these crimes. I mean, to show to the people and to let the people know about what's going on. But it's sad that the distributors in the U.S. so far do not want to take a little bit of risk, political risk, and to show this documentary to the audience. I'm really sad about it, that there is no big distributor is taking No Other Land and showing to the American people. It's very important to reach to the Americans, I believe. And so far, we are doing it independently on the cinemas.
And your co-director is Israeli. Have you come under criticism for working with Israelis on the film?
So far, I'm not receiving any criticism for working with Israeli. I working together is that because we share in somehow the same values, that we reject the injustice and the occupation and the apartheid of what's going on, and we want to work pro solution and pro justice and to end this like settlements and for a better future.
Basel, the Oscars are soon, in a few weeks. Can you get a visa to come into the United States? Will you attend the Oscars?
So I have visa so far because I've been in the U.S. participating in festivals for our movie. But my family and the other Palestinian co-directors does not have yet, and they will try to apply soon, and hopefully they will get it, and they will be able to join us in the Oscar.
So since it's so difficult to see your film here in the United States, I want to go to another clip of No Other Land. Again, this is our guest Basel Adra and his co-director Yuval Abraham filming the eviction of a Palestinian family.
A lot of army is here.
They plan a big demolition?
We don't know. They're driving towards one of my neighbors.
Now the soldiers arrive here. He's...
Aren't you ashamed to do this? Aren't you afraid of God?
Go back. Move back now. Get back. I'll push you all the way back.
I speak Hebrew. Don't shout.
I hope that bulldozer falls on your head. Why are you taking our homes? Why destroy the bathroom?
That's Israeli bulldozers destroying a bathroom. This is another clip from No Other Land in which you, Basel, are attacked by Israeli forces even as you try to show them you have media credentials.
I'm filming you. I'm filming you. You're just like criminals.
You get closer and arrest him.
You're expelling us. Arrest me. On what grounds?
Grab them.
On what grounds? I have a journalist's card. I have a journalist's card.
Shut up.
Don't hit my son. Leave our village. Go away. Leave you. Shoot.
Move back.
Shoot me. Shoot me. Shoot me.
Get an ambulance.
Run, Basel, run. Get up, son, run. Run, Basel.
Basel, that is you. Your mother is hanging on to you as you're being dragged, your father. What do you want the world to know about Mustafa Yatta, about your community in this film?
I want the world to really act seriously. The international community should take measures and act seriously to end this, like demolitions and ethnic cleansing that it's happening everywhere in Gaza, in the West Bank, through different policies and different like reasons that the Israelis try to separate out, which is all lies. It's all about land, that they want to steal more and more of our land. That's very clear on the ground, because every Palestinian community being erased, there is a settlement growing in the same place. This is happening right there in the South Hebron Hills, in everywhere around the West Bank in Area C, and now they are entering camps since January until now by demolishing, like destroying the camps in Jenin, Tulkarem, and Tubas, and forcing people to leave their homes to get away. And the world is just keep watching and not taking serious actions. And the opposite, actually, the Israelis kept receiving all like this amount of violations of the international law, the human rights laws. It's very clear that it's violated every day by the Israelis, but nobody almost cares. The opposite. They kept receiving weapons and money and relationships diplomatic covers.
We have to leave it there. I thank you so much. Look forward to interviewing you and Yuval in the United States. Basil Adra, co-director of the Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land.
On Saturday, March 8 at 7 p.m., join the Agnes Etherington Art Center as they bring back their popular series, Open Secret. In this third edition, the Agnes partners with New York Film Festival, Prismatic Ground, and its artistic director, Inay Prakash, for a screening of five short works by filmmaker